Tonight's guest has led a distinguished career in both the private and public sectors. Tonight is a trip home for Mr. Kirk. He was born in Newton, Massachusetts, and received his degrees from Harvard College and here at the law school before joining the Boston law firm of Hale & Dorr. Besides working at several other law firms, including most recently as a partner at Sullivan & Worcester, Mr. Kirk has led an extensive career in the public sector. Before joining the Democratic National Committee as the treasurer in 1983, he served as a district attorney in Middlesex County, as assistant counsel to U.S. Senate Judiciary Subcommittee, and as special assistant to Senator Edward Kennedy. He was named to his current position as chairman in 1985. Mr. Kirk's special interest in the upcoming election, which hopefully he'll be sharing his thoughts on with us tonight, is ensuring that the Democratic candidates take the high road in campaign ethics and tactics, and encouraging the candidates to work together towards a common goal, namely electing a Democratic president. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm pleased to present Mr. Paul Kirk.
Thank you very much, Fiona, and thank you folks for being here this evening. I don't know how we arranged the schedule for me to get between Christy Hefner and Miss Manners, but Democrats will do anything these days, you know. But I am grateful to you folks for being here on a rainy night. I know it's between the holy days, and therefore to be here and take a little time to discuss some of the issues of the day is gratifying to me as an alumnus of this school. The one thing I was always clear about in this room as I came in as a student is that Harvard Law School was always the great equalizer. No matter where you came from, or where you went to school, or how you participated in anything, you came here, you were humbled within the first several days. I graduated in 1964, and I found out tonight nothing's changed. I went with Fiona and the board of the Harvard Law School Forum to Pistachio's restaurant. We had a lovely table over there, and people set up and had a glass of wine and people getting ready to eat. And, I thought, well, this is a special day for an old alum to come back to Harvard Square and prestigious Harvard Law School Forum. And so as the waiter went by, I noticed a number of the folks there had put butter on their plates for the bread, and I didn't get any. So I asked the waiter, I said, you suppose I could have a couple of pads of butter? The fellow looked at me and he said, well, no, you can't. And this is not typical of me, my own character. I'm not usually rather, I like to believe I'm not obnoxious, but I figured, Jesus, here it is. I'm coming back home to Massachusetts, Harvard Law School, and I said, maybe you don't know who I am. The guy said, no, I don't know. Who are you? I said, well, I'm chairman of the Democratic Party, and I'm here to speak at the Harvard Law School Forum. And I said, can I have two pads of butter? He said, no. I said, what do you mean, no? He said, maybe you don't know who I am. I said, I don't know who you are. Who are you? He said, I'm the guy in charge of the butter. So it just goes to show you how much clout a party chairman has coming back to his alma mater and, needless to say, humbled right away. But I wanted to just talk not too long tonight about, somebody said, well, what will your topic be? And I said, well, it's about the politics of values and the value of politics as we look ahead to 1988 in particular, and as we move from what I think will be the administration of one party to an administration of another party. The interesting thing to note also, I think, is that as you measure both the leadership of the party and the candidates who are aspiring to the presidency, take note of the fact that Bruce Babbitt, Mike Dukakis, yours truly are graduates of Harvard Law School. Al Gore, also a candidate for the presidency, was a graduate of Harvard University. The Republican side, George Bush, Yale, of course. However, Pierre DuPont IV studied here in Austin North, so there's a little equalizer there as well. The point is that there are those who sat where you folks are sitting who have felt that there's enough involved in what has to be done both in the country and whatever to serve in public life and seek the highest office that the country bestows and the highest honor that a party can bestow, that is its presidential nomination. The 1988 is going to be, I think, one of the most interesting political years for those who are interested in following presidential politics for a number of reasons. Not the least of which is that the seat at the White House is going to be vacated. For the first time since 1968, it'll be an open seat. Just as in 1968, there will be a vice president of the party of the president who's vacating that office, who will be the front runner and aspiring to succeed. That, of course, is a Republican. Prior to that, the only other time in recent memory was in 1968, when Vice President Humphrey was the party's nominee and the seat was vacant. May not be a portent of history, but in both instances, those vice presidents who were the nominees of the parties lost in the race for the presidential election. Needless to say, from my point of view, it would be fine if Vice President Bush were the nominee of the Republican Party and history repeated itself, but that's something that, if it's going to happen, the Democrats have to earn it. We won't win it by default. There are a lot of issues out there to be discussed and debated. The other unique factor, I think, is that obviously we've been through, or will have been through, 8 years where the personification of the President of the United States and the embodiment in one individual of the Republican Party of the 1980s will have basically left the scene, and that, of course, is President Reagan. There are a lot of, therefore, sometimes or somewhat unique and interesting factors that will come to play as the campaigns unfold. But I think there are some other things that are rather curious as we think about as what has happened, some of the things that have changed, some of the things that have been fulfilled over the last several years, and some of those that have not. And it may be not only curious, but it may be somewhat like the perspective of Alice in Wonderland after Alice fell down the rabbit hole and the world was, if not topsy-turvy, it sure had a curious perspective to it. You have a situation where, unlike in the past, you have the Democrats talking about fiscal responsibility after the Republican budget deficits, and you have the Republicans basically talking about free trade, which was a change, at least in the parlance, from what had happened previously. But in the real issues that we've seen over the last several years, I think back to 1981 and the agenda that we heard about and the things that really can put Alice in Wonderland in a special light of wondering who's telling us what really happened. In 1981, the Republican Party ran on a platform of fiscal conservatism and promised to balance the nation's budget by 1983. We now have $220 billion in budget deficits. That's more deficit accumulated under the Republican Party of the 1980s than all the budgets and all the deficits of all the presidents from George Washington to Jimmy Carter combined. We heard about the great American comeback, and the figures show that the United States of America has gone from the largest creditor nation to the largest debtor nation in the world in the last 6.5 years. The status of a competitive United States of America has basically also been turned on its head, as we've had $170 billion in trade deficits, which the economists will say mean that's $4 million being exported overseas, and a national debt that has doubled to an excess of $2 trillion. So the issues of fiscal conservatism and responsibility are not only gravely serious, but as a political matter, I think the Republican Party will not be able to really come back and hitting hard to the country about the sense of fiscal prudence and management of the important budget process. The other thing that strikes me as somewhat curious about the change in dialogue and understanding of what's going on in the political world is in 1984, Ronald Reagan, as a Republican, ran to the United States of America and asked the people basically to remember the Republic's greatest days. And in helping them remember, he never chose to invoke the name of any Republicans. But if you remember that campaign, wherever he went, he spoke of Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman, John Kennedy, Hubert Humphrey, Scoop Jackson, everyone a national Democrat. And the Democrats lost 49-1. And after it was over, they said, well, the only way the Democrats can survive and succeed is to become more like the Republican Party. And our party went through what pundits and editors described as a period of soul searching. The party had an identity crisis, wasn't sure where it was going, what it had to do to reclaim its heritage and get on with the future. And a lot of people within the party did go to work. And went to work in, I think, a pragmatic, common sense way to try to address some of the issues that needed to be addressed, both in terms of the perception of the party and what needed to be done in the elections of 1986. So comes 1986. And remembering 1984, if you think back, basically there was no real agenda that the Republicans ran on. It was basically a continuation of the theme of we're doing okay and we're feeling good and it's morning in America and everything's great and don't forget our Democratic heroes. But comes 1986, the single most important objective of the Reagan administration in its second term was what? Hold the Senate majority. There are a couple of things that were clear that without a real agenda to then move forward on that they hadn't already accomplished, they had to hold the majority of the Senate. And as you know, even though being outspent considerably, and because there was no basic theme, they turned to the most powerful political vehicle that the Republican Party had, its own embodiment, the President of the United States. Enormously popular, where he made basically a personal appeal that a vote for Paula Hawkins is a vote for me, or a vote for Mack Mattingly is a vote for me. And the Democrats, in the end, were able to win a substantial majority in the United States Senate. And those issues, keep in mind, took place before the Iran-Contra crisis, and they were elections won on choices for the next 6 years and getting on with the future. Now comes that verdict in 1986. The Republican National Committee meets in Washington, D.C. to revisit what happened in those elections. And Paul Laxalt, Frank Farrenkopf, Bob Dole speak to the Republican National Committee, and what do they say? We can't go on like this. We're not going to win elections if we looked on as being anti-government or looked at as not being compassionate. A storm rises in the Republican National Committee. What do you mean? Be more like the Democrats? So again, you had an election result and an identity crisis about where do the Republicans go from here and how are they going to basically contend with the next couple of years of the Reagan administration. I mentioned that in the 1980s, there was, particularly in the first few years, there were some certain things that were fulfilled on the Republican agenda. They accomplished the defense buildup that the American people thought they wanted and were told that they needed in the elections of 1980 and 1981. We had a big tax cut. We had, without question, a fulfillment of the promise or the articulation of the idea in the inaugural address of President Reagan that government, indeed, is not the solution. Government is the problem. We're going to have to get government off the back of the American people, whatever rhetoric may have been used. There are those who speculate that the real goal of the Republican Party was not to reduce the budget deficit to zero, but to reduce government to zero at every level, except for the military. Those, in addition to which, to give President Reagan the credit he deserves before the Iran situation, I think he was able to elevate the institution of the presidency back to a level where people could feel good about it. And he spent a lot of his time telling the American people to feel good about themselves and feel good about the country. He clearly reduced the interest rates and the level of inflation, and I think therefore enjoyed goodwill as a personally popular president. With respect to the next couple of years, and particularly after the Iran-Contra situation, I think I can say, even though it does sound rather partisan, that basically the administration is running on empty. There is no agenda left, except, as everyone hopes, they're able to put something together in terms of the arms treaty. But the rest of it is basically a holding action. The things that they set out to do to basically realign the country have not taken place. The budget, the trade, the economic leadership have basically not been successes. And the country, I think, is going to have to go through some difficult times grappling with that legacy. And most important of all, I think, is some of the things that I think we ought to reflect about as we prepare for 1988. And that is, we heard so much rhetoric about values and about traditional American values and the politics of values in the campaigns of 1981 and 1984. My own definition of both the politics of values, whether they happen to be in families or neighborhoods or societies or in public life, one of the important things is to try to leave something better than what we found. I think it's part of ingrained in the American heritage and ingrained in what we want to do as a people and as individuals. Obviously, as students of the law, law is public policy. Public policy is translated many times through political action and activities. We have certain philosophies and ideas, ideals and attitudes that we have, I like to believe, that are in common. And I think one of the things that we're going to be groping for as a country, and I believe it will take place within the debate in the Democratic Party, that the country is going to arrive at a shared vision of its own national character in the elections of 1988. And as we do, I think we will look back and hear some of the rhetoric about values, about we can't have permissiveness, we need constitutional amendments to balance the budget, we may need constitutional amendments to prohibit freedom of choice, we may need tuition tax credits, we may need prayer in schools, and these are the things that will avoid our society from being permissive, and that will straighten everything out. Well, for those of us that are active in politics and understand, as I know you folks do, that it is, in the best sense of the word, the serious business of the people, there's a lot more to politics and public life and values than just those ideas. We've seen, without the kind of calling to the higher ideals, we've seen another kind of permissiveness, I think, both from Pennsylvania Avenue to Wall Street. You've had members of our own profession on insider trading, whatever it might be, for material gain in the politics of greed. You've had people coming out of the White House and trading on their associations and trying to sell off their companies for millions of dollars and grab it while you can kind of approach to life. We've had a rhetoric in the 1984 election about traditional American values. Sometimes when I think of the traditional symbol of an American value, even though I'm from this part of the country, I think first of all about the family farmer and what has happened in terms of our approach to that problem and showing any kind of need or understanding for what is going on. And basically a glib gag line of export the farmers became, unfortunately, a policy that was visited on that part of the country and cost, I think, the Republican Party some political consequences in 1986. Cutting of student loans, on the one hand, talking about the crusade against drugs and enforcement, slashing the drug program and saying, just say no, we'll do it, is not the way to, I think, really take a hard, fast look at what's needed on some of the issues of public policy. The foreign policy issue and the scandal of the Iran-Contra situation was basically one where it's either based on ignorance or deniability, either one of which, in terms of the agenda for this country, is not the way to be dealing with the American people's business and their expectation that, if nothing else, we're going to get competence and credibility from the highest office in the land. The Republican Party had to be dragged kicking and screaming by the Democrats and other leaders around the world and the country on the issue of South Africa. They came to the issue of apartheid slowly and reluctantly, and even now in terms of the issues of some of the questions of race and civil rights within the country, there's still so much more to do, while some of the highest legal officials are sounding retreat on those policies. I happen to think and worry about the fact that we've had several years of where it's been survival of the fittest. If you're lucky and blessed with certain resources and make it, good luck to you. Basically, it's a go-it-alone approach to where we are as a society. And I sense, unfortunately, a creeping separatism that is evolving both between regions of the country and economic sectors, between individuals and races, even between ages. And if there's one thing that I think will be different as we move ahead to the 88 election, some of the things that I think can bind us together and will take place in the debate within the Democratic Party. One is the continuing respect that we must have for the rule of law, an increased appreciation for a pragmatic, positive, and principled role of government. By that I mean not necessarily massive federal spending that can't take place now with the budget crisis, but a public-private partnership that can help to do some of the things that we have to do as a society if we're going to make it together. We had a Democratic Policy Commission we put together during those rather dismal times of 85 and 86, when people said the Democratic Party is going through its identity crisis. If there's one thing that became clear to me in traveling and sitting in on every one of those meetings and discussions, it's that within this country, the greatest strength we have is our diversity, and that as a country, we better understand, with all the competition, both within our society and from abroad, we're all in this together. This is not a period where we all make it on our own. You can look at the demographics, and you can see expanding groups within this country. And some of the expanding groups are people who have a different color skin than mine. And you see increasing numbers of children in poverty, and you see exploding numbers of aging and middle-class population that are living a longer period of life. I can just tell you that unless we make up our minds that we are going to invest in the education of those children, we are in for serious problems as a society. Not just because they won't be able to get a sound education and be able to earn a living for their own families, but because they won't be able to get a decent job and provide the wages and the income provide for us on our Social Security times, but they're not going to be able to make and create the quality skilled goods we're going to need if we're going to compete in the global marketplace. So there's a continuum that goes, in my own opinion, from prenatal health care and education and job training all the way through to where we're going to be as a whole society. By the same token, you learn very quickly as you travel around and listen to the problems around this country that when a farm forecloses in the Midwest, it's not just that community and the banks around it and the small businesses that are going to suffer. It's the plant that makes the tractor and the machinery for that farm, or the steel mill that provides that metal for that tractor, or the energy forge that fuels the fire to make that steel, or the high-tech plant that may be wanting to modernize that steel plant. There is a ripple effect about what's going on and what has to go on in terms of our own community. And I think it's that recognition of how we are kind of interdependent and locked in together and have to share and work together, even though we may have individual rights, that there are very, very important shared responsibilities that we have to consider and think of as we move ahead. And I think you're going to see in the Democratic Party of 1988 people talking about those needs and about investing in people and investing in the future. On all the things that we talk and care about, from education and job training and health care and affordable housing and being competitive and as a society, it won't just do to have protectionism to make it happen for us. We've got to be as tough on ourselves and sort of putting it together here at home as we may have to be tough-minded about a free and open marketplace around the globe. If there was one, I suppose there are two stories that I learned out of the human side and the human terms of what some of the work we did in the Policy Commission. One was the story about a young woman who was the daughter of a black sharecropper from Georgia. She was the oldest of 13 children and as such took care of her younger brothers and sisters and had kind of a special maternal care for them and dreamt all her life of wanting to be a doctor. And she moved from Georgia and came here to Massachusetts. And it didn't work out. She got trapped on the web of welfare and she ended up having three children and found that after 14 years there was little if any opportunity. But with some public-private partnership, understanding the need and the choice that that woman had to make, she would never go to work and leave three young kids at home. And no mother would do it. But as long as there was an understanding that if she could maintain her medical benefits for a year and have child care for those kids and have some sort of job training, she'd take the chance. She took the chance. She's now paying taxes to the Commonwealth. Her pride in her family is restored. She's a medical technician at Women and Brigham Hospital here in Boston. And it's an example of what can happen when we understand that there is a role for government, there is a sense of the need to have the toughness to govern and the compassion to care and to be able to make this society productive. The other, I think, more challenging story and somewhat more dramatic was the story of a couple out in the Midwest. This fellow was the son of a steel worker, and he had been a steel worker himself. Plant had closed, he'd been laid off. He and his wife each had two jobs, both lower paying, obviously, than what he worked at the steel mill. They had three children. The oldest was 16. And they did everything you'd expect. They paid their bills, they paid their taxes, they were still in search of the sort of the great American comeback they'd heard about. They looked for affordable housing. At the end of one of these particular weeks, the wife said to the husband, "How is it that we're working harder even than our parents had, and already we know that none of our kids will be able to send to college because we can't afford it?" And the husband turned to the wife and he said, "I'll tell you what the problem is. The trouble with the world today is the future is not what it used to be." Now, I'll tell you, if there's one eloquent challenge to where we are in terms of our own relationship and what we need to do as a country, is to make sure that in the value structure we can reclaim what we always wanted to do, and that is to make sure what we leave behind for our kids is better than what we had and what we inherited. It's, I suppose, if I remembered best, the two most popular figures, political figures in my lifetime. One happened to be a much older president. He's now the incumbent, a Republican. In 1984, even though there was no great theme or agenda, he went to the American people and he had one compelling statement or question. Are you better off than you were 4 years ago? The other president, who was a much younger man, and when I was studying here at Harvard Law School, he was president of the United States, he was a Democrat. He had another outlook and approach to it all. And his compelling statement was, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. Think about it. One was an appeal to personal and individual self-interest. Not that any of us are going to denigrate the importance of economic well-being. But the other was basically a call to patriotism and national greatness and sense of sharing and sense of input and community spirit. A lot of people have drawn parallels between the election of 1960 and the election of 1988. And about the fact that there will be a generational change. And I think there will be. And I like to take heart from the fact that those who are running in the Democratic Party are basically those who are about my age and remember that impression. And that's probably why a lot of them got into public life. And I like to say about a lot of things, you never get a second chance to make a first impression. And the impression that you get from that president on these young people, I think it's going to be the reason that in 1988 that your generation, as well as mine and others, are going to be challenged. Because the problems are great. We can't gloss them over. We can't solve them individually. It's going to take a politics of common sense, and it's going to take a real sense of common purpose about all of us pitching in together. So the other side, I guess, and in closing is, having talked a little bit about the politics of values, is what I think for particularly a group like this is the value of politics. And I am not one who comes here and advocates that politics ought to be the exclusive profession of those who choose it as a career. There may be all kinds of arguments, in fact, why it shouldn't be. But the one thing I will argue for is whatever course you follow or path you pursue, at some point, you're going to have to take advantage of the resources that have been given you by your education, and you're going to be among the leaders of the cutting edge of this next generation. And I think, like others have said before, with that opportunity comes an enormous responsibility. And the times have never been greater. I know there's an indictment that's unfairly said about people of your age and younger, that it's all materialism and it's all self-interest and whatever. That may be true for some, but on the whole, I think it's unfair. I think also, I believe if the whole generation were that way, it would be short-sighted, be to our own detriment. And I think if you make up your mind at some point to make some contribution, it doesn't have to be running for President of the United States, it can be for the school board or city council or participating somehow in the public domain, because the education, the background of law, politics, public policy is intertwined as well. And I believe that a lot of people will be looking to you for example and leadership and public life as well as in the private sector. So I hope that 1988 will be a reason to pay close attention, to really find the kinds of values that make a difference for our society. I like to think that if we conduct our campaign right, that those values will be restored in the Democratic Party, and we'll go on to have the kind of an administration that can reaffirm the best heritage of the Democratic Party as well as the best future we can have as a country. So enough of that, and Fiona says the rest of it is for Q&A and open forum.
Obviously, for a number of reasons, 1984 wasn't a year of success for the Democrats in terms of the presidential election. But it seemed as though whatever chance they did have of capturing the White House in that year was destroyed entirely by a grueling and a long and grueling primary campaign, which seemed to leave the party completely divided and left the eventual winner very vulnerable to attack. 88, by all preliminary indications, looks like it will be a good year for the Democrats, but do you fear a similar type of primary campaign which could leave the party splintered? And what are you going to try and do as chairman to promote a positive campaign which first and foremost will stress the unification of the party?
The I watched the 1984 campaign obviously with some interest and some dismay, and I like to believe that when we're brought to our knees 4 out of 5 times, we'll also be brought to our senses. And you're quite right that some of the things that happened within the Democratic Party in the campaign of 1984 were things that lingered and I thought were costly in terms of our own fortunes when it cut to the general election. With that in mind, funny you should ask this question, but that says, Chairman issues resolves for 1988. About 2 or 3 weeks ago, I spoke to the National Press Club in Washington. Really, the audience was the presidential campaigns and the candidates. One thing that I promised them is that as chairman of the party, I'd be absolutely neutral throughout this contest until the nomination was secured. The other thing I wanted to do, and so far I think we're going to get cooperation on it, is within the party apparatus, get rid of the straw polls. They extended the calendar of the campaign in an artificial way, had nothing to do with delegate selection. They cost every one of the candidates precious money that they didn't have to spend and couldn't afford to spend. And I think we ought to be spending less time on these artificial horse races and more time on the substance of what the candidates have to say and why they're running for President of the United States. In addition, I have asked the candidates not to, for short-sighted campaign tactics, to run against certain constituencies of the party and to beat up on them for short-term gain, because obviously when you get to the general election, you're going to need every constituency at the front end and united behind whoever the nominee is. I've asked the candidates not to run against the Democratic Party or to do any party bashing, and to support the nominee, whoever that may be. And to a couple of other things, to participate in the general election debates the parties will sponsor for the general election. But the most important one, I hope, will be trying to assure that the campaign of 1988 within the Democratic Party gets away from negative campaigning. When we went through 1981 to 1988, people will understand quickly enough what the Democrats are against. What they want to know is what they're for. They don't want to hear the worst about the other candidates. They want to understand why the Democratic standard bearer or that candidate is best for them. The 1986 elections for the Senate and the Congress, it was a new low in content and negative TV ads and a new high in terms of its cost. We've got the second lowest voter turnout of any advanced democracy in the world. And political parties can't solve all the problems, but they can at least give people a reason to come to the polls. And I've said, and I believe, that the single most important get-out-the-vote program that the Democratic Party can embark on is to restore respect for our own process by giving a positive message of hope to an American audience. Now, it isn't going to be easy, because in the tensions and pressures of a political campaign, with the consultants saying, oh, go the low road or whatever, the temptation is great. But I also asked five other leading Democrats to serve with me to monitor the tenor and tone of that debate and to try to assure we'll bring private pressure where we have to and public pressure when it's necessary to try and make sure that we stay on the high road. In addition to which hasn't been done before, is I'll be meeting with the candidates themselves and with their designated representatives probably once a month or as necessary to make sure that we take care of whatever grievances privately and try to avoid a lot of public negative bashing. My hope is that this will result in a spirited, civil, constructive, and truly presidential dialogue. And that without the straw polls through 1987, that the press and others will get a chance to really report on what these candidates are about and what they stand for, and not necessarily have to go through the artificial sound bites that come out in the midst of a campaign and all you get is a quick quote here and a quick quote there. So I hope we're going to improve the process, and I agree with you, it has been a concern, and I hope the steps and measures we'll take will make a difference. Yes, sir. Well, on the first point, I think it's what I see, frankly, is coming up within the Democratic Party, at least, is not a great ideological struggle. I mean, I don't think necessarily the question of whether the bumper stickers on the Democratic Party wagon are pointing to left or right are necessarily going to make all the difference in the world about where the national audience goes. I think, on the other hand, we're going to have to be talking about issues that are central to the concerns of the American people, and that's economic growth and investing in the future in terms of education and infrastructure and the kinds of things that families and individuals are concerned about. And that, unlike the Republicans, we understand that there is a role for government in all of those areas without smothering it or strictly throwing dollars after the problem. So I think it's a combination of, I'll say that, as I said, sort of the toughness of management and pragmatism on the one hand and the compassion to care about individuals and society on the other. And, I mean, people can define it in their own terms. I do think in the larger battleground for the body politic of this country, you're not going to win it on the left or right fringe. The most The real battleground will be which political party can get the most of the center and whichever side it chooses to be of the center, and that'll be the battleground, that'll be the winning margin. So I think what a lot of people who were running against the Democratic Party in its national image in the past and winning as Democrats in the South and the West, which we need to win, didn't like the image of the Democratic Party. Somehow we'd been off on exotic and fringy issues that weren't about their kids and their future and their livelihood and the defense of the country and so forth. We've got to be serious about those issues. Some of the other issues will be part of the dialogue, but they can't control the dialogue. The question on the Republican side, my guess is that, for having said that about the Democrats, that there's a real likelihood that the division and struggle ideologically will take place within the Republican Party. The radical right, after Ronald Reagan, is going to fight to control that party. And then there's the sort of Republican establishment, if you will, that's going to want to hold on to its part of it. And the big fight and struggle will be within that party. I think they're going to see within the Democratic Party, on the other hand, an emerging consensus, a more understanding about, you know, people and individuals, yet bringing them together into sort of a sense of common purpose. In terms of the individuals, I mean, I would say that George Bush has the unhappy kind of obligation of coming into a campaign like this and saying, things have never been so great and I'm the only guy who can clean up this mess. I mean, it's like, which way do you want it? You know, I mean, he's got himself as a loyal vice president with all the pros and cons on that side, and then he's going to explain all the other things that I think that are going to be a part of people's mindset and thought and agenda and concern. Bob Dole has, I think, distanced himself from the administration in times where it was both convenient and perhaps where he thought practical and perhaps even right. And I think from where he was in the campaign of 1976 to his position when he was majority leader, I think he really showed quantum leaps in terms of statesmanship. Jack Kemp, well, I'll tell you, I don't know, as the father of supply-side economics, I think he's going to have a tough time explaining that one, although I think he's got, you know, he's got a populist appeal if we're talking about a generational change. He's going to have, you know, some strengths in that regard. I think Pat Robertson has peaked. Al Haig, he was in control some time back. Pierre DuPont, tough. But I think that's going to be a struggle within that party. And I think if, you know, as I said at the outset, if the vice president runs to succeed the president of the United States, we probably have a pretty good opportunity for ourselves. I think the other side of it is, though, as I mentioned in my speech to the press club, this campaign won't be won by default. It can't be won by default. We got to go out and earn it. And I think that's what the American people expect. You've got a majority now in both houses of the Congress. All the papers are filled with the Iran situation. The Democrats, in the meanwhile, I'll tell you, are doing the work and are putting an agenda together. And I think we're going to be ready, and if we can keep the presidential debate positive, we will have earned it. Yes, sir. Without question, the character of a public figure will always be a measure or an issue for people to take stock of during a campaign, and I think campaigns in and of themselves are a grueling test of some of the marks of character. And I think one thing that if we have an emerging consensus on public policy issues, the temptation oftentimes is for, therefore, to distinguish oneself from the other candidates, start make some sort of a character attack. That's the kind of thing, as I mentioned earlier, to the degree we can prevent it, it's off limits, so that we can stay on the substance. The foreign policy issue will always be an issue. I believe that if you had to weigh and stack up the issues as we go ahead, I think the questions of economic growth and security and well-being will be probably the principal substantive issue. And that takes in the whole range of the budget, the trade deficit, our area of competition in the world, and being able to provide what is the greatest and most vital social program, if we're going to do anything, is a growing and strong, diversified, balanced economy. If we can't have that, we can't make these investments we talk about, and we can't provide for the defense. So that will be, I think, the central question. With respect to the Democratic candidates, since I've made my first pledge to be neutral, I'm not going to violate it here at Harvard Law School. I do think that each of the candidates bring, you know, a particular strength to the dialogue. Some have varied experiences. Some of their experiences are similar. But the thing that strikes me is that a lot, they're about the same age, and I see basically a shared outlook about these, that it really is a sense of more of a community of interest, that is not going to be done by a single president. It's going to take the private sector, it's going to take cooperation between labor and management and a mix of partnerships. It's not going to be like the so-called new federalism, which means you got all the problems and none of the revenues. You're on your own. I think the true sense of federalism will be some sort of partnership between the federal government, the state, and local, without having the federal government bear all the costs, trying to leverage enough money to spur initiatives and creativity and investments that are going to make a difference. And a lot of, almost every one of the candidates is on, I think, that kind of a track. You have, obviously, with Gary Hart and Jesse Jackson are the two candidates who have run before. They have, therefore, the advantage of knowing the ordeal of a long national campaign, and they have, therefore, the name recognition. You then have a number of candidates who are qualified, who have never sought national office before, but have distinguished public service and have good records of experience. And basically, I mean, that's what a campaign is about. Who can ring the bell and get people involved and charged up and appreciating strength of character and where they are on the issues? And I think a campaign is as much an education for these candidates as it is for the people themselves. So I would just say, with respect to delegate selection, my own view is, despite the polls, this thing is wide open. And, you know, that's a year from January, it's next February, so it's still a long way to go. I think it's wide open, and if somebody said to me, where do you think it is on delegate selection, I'd tell you it's a dead heat today.
Reality that we don't want to face. It didn't go over very well in the general election. It seems like there is some bad news as part of the next few years of budgets, which is revenues are going to have to go up and expenditures are going to have to come down. And how are the Democrats going to package that in a way that it's not going to turn off the electorate?
I tell you, I think not just a tax question, but generally speaking, I was saying to the group at dinner, I mean, I've had people say to me, well, now you've won the Senate, and I suppose the most important thing that could happen in terms of fulfillment of the chairmanship is to have a Democrat elected president. And my response, as you might imagine, is that would be kind of nice. And the response, on the other hand, is you're wrong. I said, why am I wrong? Well, because the problems are so grave that if your party does what it has to do to straighten them out, you'll be out of power for 50 years. Now, that is the dark side of the moon. The question, though, comes back to how do we realistically assess the difficulties that lie ahead of us and still provide the positive message of hope that people say, look, we're an optimistic, confident, hopeful nation, and we're tired of hearing the doom and gloom. All we need to do is, what, you know, tell us what the answer is. Well, the answer isn't just going to be, well, we'll raise your taxes and it'll all be straightened out. The truth is that, in terms of just the recent scenario, the Democrats have come in lower in terms of budget appropriations and cutting spending than the Republicans have on a number of instances. In the Republican budget, there are $22 billion in new revenues. In the Democrats, there's 18. The Democrats is only it's a budget resolution. It doesn't point to any particular taxes or identify. The Republicans are talking about user fees and enhanced revenues and other measures to try and get some new revenues into the mix. There isn't any question, whichever party addresses in a serious-minded way, there are going to have to be some increases in revenues. And I think the one question is, basically, how you package it. just as you say. I think it has to be, it has to basically come back in some ways, perhaps, identifying if there is going to be taxing, and there already is in terms of the paralyzing the budget, the people that are paying and the people that aren't getting services they deserve, and others are paying in any event, is who is going to pay, over what period of time and how much. There are a lot of different alternatives that are being talked about. I've heard talk about the transaction tax and an oil import fee and any number of alternatives, gasoline tax, excise tax on liquor and cigarettes. People don't like to talk about income tax too much. That's the one that hurts most of all. But there's going to be some, I'm sure there's going to be some measures for increased revenues, because there's going to have to be. And I think it may be a part of just sort of the general sense that, look, if we're going to make it through this thing, we are all in this together, we're going to have to make some sacrifices if we're going to invest in the future of this country and invest in its basic resources, the people. Unless we make up our minds to that, that there's going to be also, obviously, on the other side, some balance in terms of the defense questions and the rest of it. But to make it up, there has to, I think there's going to be, have to be some revenues. And it's basically, I think, going to be education and challenging the American people about, if we're going to be hopeful and confident and optimistic again about ourselves and our kids, we better start doing it now. But the other thing is, I mean, just in terms of Jim Wright's equations, sometimes it may be that he's reaching out perhaps to Howard Baker, who understands the process, who has a greater belief in government than I think the president does, that there may be some time left for a budget summit that would work out some bipartisan package. I don't put much faith in it or hope in it, because the president's basically said no way, but that's another possibility. Yes, sir.
A recurring theme in your talk tonight and others has been the role of government, and I guess it has to be in a conversation like this. And that really is, I mean, the fundamental difference between a Republican and a Democrat, what the role of government really is in society. And what is it? When you look at the globe, you see these different states and the role that government plays in different countries. What is it that gives you such confidence that government really is?
Because if you believe, as I do, that some people, first of all, just can't make it, and other people need incentives to make it, or some breaks, and I mentioned this Ruby Sampson, who was the woman on welfare with three kids, unless there had been some leveraging of public-private money and understanding the dilemma that human being had to face, she and her kids are forever dependent on the state. Now, that's not the way government ought to operate, because everybody's drained, and we're not doing the kinds of things that putting her to work and make the economy grow and making her a productive citizen and adding to it. You go around this country in almost every city. I mean, there are homeless people around the country. There are more kids in poverty than ever before. The middle class has been sapped away. There's a division between the classes in terms of incomes. And I don't say that government's going to solve all that. But if people are left to their own, without the leveraging, without the leadership, without the kind of public example and the public spirit and challenge, we're not going to make it. It isn't all the answers, but there is that legitimate role in terms of our society and the public domain, and where people can't make it and need some sort of hand and help. A government is more than just taxing and building weapons. There are schools and hospitals and facilities and child care and all the things we're talking about, education and job training and quality of life, that public leadership has to be able to articulate and challenge a society and challenge the other forces within it. Educational society, what are they? I mean, Harvard Law School, Harvard College, contributions to the public dialogue, the private sector, I mean, here in Boston as well, on housing and cooperative partnerships. So I think it's a respect for what I say is a really a principled and pragmatic role for government, not saying, Jesus, government's got all the answers, throw the bucks at it. We've tried that, and in many ways we wasted a lot, and perhaps we wasted a lot of human resources too. But I think it is a key distinction. I mean, I said that in many ways the Republican Party took a scorched earth policy toward government. And if they could reduce it to zero, all the better. And I think we're paying some of that price now. Yes, sir, behind me.
Assisting those who are not self-sufficient. You don't put a burden on people who might be marginally self-sufficient, so that you actually increase the number of people who are dependent. There is a considerable speculation that's what has happened in 50 years.
Well, that's I think that's one of the things that, for instance, the Democrats got themselves locked into a perception that all they cared about was the poor in recent years, where in fact it was the Democratic Party that built the middle class under Franklin Roosevelt, who believed in economic growth and after we get through the World War, were productive and made the country strong and producing and a saving nation, as opposed to now we're basically a consuming, borrowing nation. We're not going to be able to do it. If I understand your question correctly, you're just saying, look, the answer to this is that they let the corporate entities and the wealthy crawl through the loopholes. We do the handouts to the poor, and the middle class pay the freight, because then all those who have been basically the core of the society is saying, we get it both ways. And I think that's where the equity in how the taxes are structured, if there are going to be taxes, and the benefits that the family that I mentioned, who aren't finding themselves in a struggle now, trying to pay all their mortgage, their taxes, they can't afford their kids to go to school, and the quality of their own life is different. And that's the kind of thing in terms of job retraining and economic growth that the Democrats have to be involved in. And those things won't happen, frankly, without incentives and leadership from government. This fellow here was waiting.
You said in the past couple of months about the effect of the Super Tuesday primary on the election campaigns. I'm curious first of what your view is of that and whether that's going to put a lot of extra pressure on the candidates to possibly disintegrate into negative campaigning early, one possible consequence. And also, secondly, whether you foresee a greater role for such regional primaries in future elections.
Yeah, the one thing that is predictable about these changes is that the outcome is usually unpredictable. But some of the leaders of the southern states were moving their calendar up. I mean, the last thing they needed to hear probably publicly was this Yankee from the north trying to tell the south what to do after we'd been croaked there in four out of the last five elections. So what I did was basically, without beating up publicly, counsel with them privately about what they were doing and perhaps some of the consequences that might flow from it. Their response basically was, for us as Democrats, who we elect Democrats here in the state and the region, we have virtually little impact or input on the nominating process, so it can't be worse for us, so we're going ahead. And it will change the dynamic, because it'll be an expensive proposition for candidates to compete in a region that large. Therefore, some say that those will benefit the most are either candidates that can afford now to mount a regional TV approach to that kind of a region, or those who get the momentum out of an Iowa or New Hampshire and therefore get the live news coverage and come into that region with a head of steam. A lot of those scenarios are possible. I think it depends who is involved, first of all, in terms of the candidates. I would guess that the Southern primary, because of its size and expense, would be one that would winnow out the process, only because the expense to take on that and not win and do substantially well, and then the ability to sustain the campaign funds necessary to go on, would be pretty tough going. Regional primaries generally I wouldn't have any problem with them. I think, however, that if you're going to have just regional primaries, you do need two or three small states before you start, so that lesser-known candidates, those who aren't enormously wealthy or very famous, can get established some amount of strength and momentum. I don't like the idea that it's Iowa and New Hampshire every 4 years. They're states that are controlled by the Republicans. They may or may not be representative, but the fact that they basically run the starting gate every 4 years, I'd much prefer that if we're going to go to regional primaries and if people agreed, yes, you need smaller states or candidates lesser known to really become competitive, that we alternate those states by lot or by region or whatever every 4 years. And also, the one thing that would happen is if the candidates didn't know which states they were, they wouldn't start campaigning 4 years before and maybe able to shorten the process. So something like that has some attractiveness if you're going to go into national campaigns. The one thing, regional campaigns, the one thing I'd be really opposed to is anything that came close to a de facto national primary. I think it'd be the wrong way to go. It, again, would argue for the candidate who was either well-known, well-financed, or if you had a, as we have had, candidates who challenge an incumbent president, the ability of a president of the United States to basically freeze the news for 2 days or 3 days around a national primary without any other option to have people visit alternatives is not healthy. And I think people expect that there be a series of hurdles that candidates have to expose themselves to and jump through in order to win the nomination. So I don't have any real problem with regional primaries, with the one caveat I mentioned. I think the, you know, the when you measure integrity or credibility or competence, I think you have to measure who the leaders are and who the nominees are. And I think more and more that the elections today are based not so much on party as they are on performance and accountability. Having said that, I'm glad to be able to say that the Democrats control the Senate and the House and the majority of the governors and state legislative bodies and 2-to-1 or more in the city halls across the country. But it comes back, I suppose, to the question that was asked earlier about or allusion to the fact of character and accountability. And that's what elections are about. And there will be, in terms of rebuilding this country, whether it's this rural economy as well as these plants that have shut down, if we're going to be a strong, vibrant economy again, it's going to take that kind of leadership and stimulation to get it going.
Just as a follow-up on that, if we control the Congress, the House and the Senate, and since the leader of the parties, hopefully the leader, Democrat, I'm saying, why don't you implement something now that will start to show the good and bad?
Well, as I say, with the majority in the Senate and the working committees in the House of Representatives, they may not be getting the headlines because of all the press visiting the Iran situation and so forth, but there is enormous amount of work being done on the Democratic agenda at this moment for the very reasons that you mentioned, of putting together an agenda so that as we go into 88 on a lot of these issues.